Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan McLeod. I'm at Kagiso Media today to chat to someone I've known for a very long time, a very smart guy who's done some really interesting stuff in the media space and in the tech space in South Africa. I'm talking about Vincent Meyer, who is now Chief Innovation Officer at Kagiso Media. Welcome to Tech Central, Vincent.
Thanks, Duncan.
Vincent, we're going to talk about esports or competitive video gaming today, which is a new area that Kagiso Media is investing in. But before we get anywhere near that subject, I want to revisit some of your career trajectory, because I think many of our listeners know about you, but perhaps don't know the full backstory about your involvement at companies like The Mail and Guardian, at Vodacom, and even at Mixit.
Right.
So let's go all the way back. You studied journalism at Rhodes, and if I recall correctly, this was before I met you, you played quite a big role in helping the university in that department actually think about new models of journalism. Just tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, so Rhodes had this thing called the New Media Lab at the time, run by this crazy Swedish professor called Roland Stanbridge. And we had like a couple of computers, and Rhodes was one of the first places that the internet came to in South Africa. So there was a lot of kind of experimentation around journalism and what would happen on the web if you started publishing multimedia, that sort of thing. So there were a core group of students and this professor who set up the New Media Lab. And after I graduated, I left and kind of did some entrepreneurial stuff for a while, and then came back to teach at Rhodes and then
run
the New Media Lab sort of five years later.
Okay. So what's some of the stuff you did there while you were there?
So we worked with the final year students. So basically the fourth year students had a specialization in new media, which we'd have them dedicated for three terms of the year. And we did a lot of multimedia production around covering the National Arts Festival, for example, all sorts of local stuff where we took photography, video, audio, and sort of mashed it together. So a lot of experimentation around new media formats. The New Media Lab doesn't exist anymore, but I think it played like quite a pivotal role for a lot of students who ended up in digital, who become quite senior now, sort of down the line.
I suppose a lot of the learnings and stuff you did then has now been integrated into the curriculum in the journalism degree, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. So there was always this question of, should it be a separate thing, digital, or should it be integrated into writing, into photography? And I think the time is kind of right now that it is just part of the DNA of a journalist.
Mm. You have to understand tech, the internet,
yeah, exactly,
all those things if you want to make a career in this space now.
Yeah, and in theory, when you apply for a job at a media company these days, there should be quite a lot of digital stuff on the, you know, on your requirements in terms of your skill set and so on, you know.
Mm.
Whereas before, it was quite specialist, and the digital people sat in one place and did their own thing.
So you then went to the Mail and Guardian, is that right?
Yeah, so the Mail and Guardian, I worked with Matthew Buckland there. And I spent 2 years there, and basically we rebooted all the digital strategy, rebuilt all the platforms. So like a massive sort of technical step forward for the Mail and Guardian.
And the Mail and Guardian was always a pioneer in the – I mean, it was the first newspaper in South Africa with a website, if I remember
correctly. Yeah, exactly. So there was a culture of trying to be first with stuff.
Mm.
So we launched a blog called Thought Leader, which is still going.
Yeah.
I think you've still got a profile on that thing.
I do. I was going to have a look.
Maybe log in and post something. And like sort of photo gallery type things and job portals and you name it. Like we basically did everything we could think of. It was a fun 2 years.
Yeah. Working with Matt, who went on to start Creative Spark, of course,
and
Lean Burn. And that's been bought out now, hasn't it?
I
forget who bought it. But he's done very well for himself.
Yeah, Matt's one of the pioneers in the industry as well. You know, he like really gets it. And he has the right sort of personality profile to push things forward on a business level. And what happened while Matt and I were there was that these two guys popped in from Silicon Valley from a company called AdMob.
Yeah.
And they took us through statistics about how mobile internet in South Africa was really, really big at the time. And this was not on our radar at all, right? So at that point, South Africa was the third biggest market for mobile advertising globally.
Wow.
And they couldn't understand why we weren't even aware of this fact, right? And there was a kind of a digital divide between people who were PC first and people who were mobile first. And PC first people couldn't conceptualize of using the internet on a Nokia.
Yes.
And people without
who'd
PCs.
Want to?
Yeah, exactly. but people without PCs, that was their only connection.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I guess the mobile guys won that debate.
They did, yeah. So what I did then is I sat down with Matt and said, okay, cool, I need to figure out this mobile thing. I'm going to go to Vodacom and learn about mobile, like sort of at what I perceive to be the coalface. So we did, we sort of developed a six-week plan on how my exit would work, wrote a bunch of code, you know, drank too much Red Bull, and then went to Vodacom to try and figure out what was happening in this mobile space, particularly around mobile internet.
Okay. So what was your role at Vodacom initially?
I was a custodian of their social media and internet products type division. Mostly focused on new product development. And it was at a time when Vodacom were putting quite a lot of money into trying to experiment with new OTT type things. So we built this location-based social network called The Grid.
Oh, yes.
Which was like Foursquare, but 2 years ahead of its time and a lot more clunky than Foursquare ended up being. Very focused on feature phones. And then we took that and we built a game called Legends of Echo. I think you were at the launch event
for
that.
Yeah. I played the game. It was also a bit ahead of its time, wasn't it? Was this in the era when Alan Knott-Craig was still running Vodacom?
So Alan's last year was my first year.
Okay.
Right, so I just sort of missed him.
Was he driving this when he, I mean, was this his passion or was it driven by someone else?
No, it was driven, you know, Vodacom is a big structure, right? So this was under Willie Ellis's team inside of the products and services group. And all the people that I worked for there, for example, like Rick Jaber went off to run successful mobile agency. It was kind of a nice starting point for a lot of people who then branched out into the industry after that.
A bit of like a training ground,
Exactly.
Okay. So how long were you there for?
Also about 2 years. Like my average tenure everywhere was about 2 years. I think this is now, in August, this will be my longest period of employment at 3 years.
Oh, dear.
My theory is that after 18 months, I stop adding value, right? So I'd have to change what I'm doing or move on.
All right. Well, hopefully Kagiso is keeping you sufficiently engaged. But after Vodacom, what happened? You went. You moved to Cape Town.
Yeah. So someone who I was working with at the Mail and Guardian, who I then brought into Vodacom, Nick Haralambos and I, launched a tech startup called Motribe. We got funding as part of the bigger Silicon Cape type movement. I think we were one of the first startups to get VC funding there. We built that business out over a period of 2 years again, and then exited, Mixit acquired the business. And then I spent 2 years at Mixit doing product management. It was quite varied. I started off running marketing at Mixit, actually, strangely enough, because at that point we thought Mixit's woes were related to marketing.
It was a turbulent time at Mixit. I mean, so much changed there in a short period of time. New investors came in.
Exactly.
I spoke to people there at the time that said that, you know, there were mistakes made, that if the right decisions had been made, that Mixit had the potential to be a global leader in instant messaging. Do you think that's a right
I think Mixit analysis? Was very well positioned. If you consider where WhatsApp was at the time, if it had made that successful transition to smartphones fast enough, it could have had an opportunity globally.
Of course, it was a feature phone-based thing initially.
Yeah. And when I joined, like 94% of the user base was on feature phone. And there was a kind of quite circumspect attitude towards smartphones, you know, that yes, it's strategically important, but it's not as burning as some of the other things that we're trying to do on feature phone at the moment. So yeah, I mean, I think it was really well positioned, and I think maybe it had some DNA problems that eventually ended up leading to its demise. I miss it though. It was like it's the first time I've worked on something with real scale. You know, they do like 30 billion transactions a month. You know, like big numbers.
I remember going down there and meeting Herman Hiernes, the founder. In Stellenbosch, just as it was starting to take off. I did a cover story for the Financial Mail when I was still working there. And it was such an interesting culture, so different to everything else we see in South Africa. Was that culture, when by the time it, you joined it, did it still have a very unique sort of
Definitely.
Different
culture? The people were diehard Mixit fans, right? And it wasn't just people messaging each other within the existing social circles. It was... you know, people who'd met each other on Mixit. So a lot of people got married and met on Mixit. It was one of those things where it built really tight culture around itself.
So, Vincent, you then left Mixit. You came to Kagiso Media immediately after that, didn't you?
Yeah, that was quite a... I just think about that quite a lot, right? Because I was sort of going on a trajectory towards social networking, mobile, and to switch back into... media again, kind of gave me pause.
And moving back to Joburg, I'm sure.
Well, so technically I don't live in Joburg, right?
Oh,
just spend 20 days a month in Joburg, but I still live in Cape
Town. That's pretty close to living.
Yeah, but my house is and my car is in Cape Town.
And your heart is in Cape Town.
Yes, exactly. And I have a team there. So,
Okay. All right, so you're physically here, but emotionally there.
No, you know what? I've had to learn to be wherever I am, right?
Yeah.
And that's been one of the biggest sort of learnings, because I used to come like every week to Joburg and then go back on the weekends, and now I spend longer times. And what I found is my team here in Joburg have a certain sort of cadence and purpose, and my team in Cape Town something slightly different, but they're more focused on product development down there. So like I relish both, like when I get on the plane, I'm looking forward to what's on the other side, regardless of which direction I'm going in.
Yeah. Oh, it's kind of fun. You have two almost different cultures. You get to make
exactly.
Great stuff. So we're going to talk a bit about competitive video gaming, which is, I must say, not an area I know very well. I went to Rage last year. And I saw a big tournament being held there, and I was absolutely amazed at the scale of it and the fact that they had an entire stand with people watching this. I play video games now and again, but not on any sort of competitive level at all. So Kagiso Media has got into the space. Let's, before we even talk about competitive gaming, let's talk a bit about Kagiso Media.
Right.
Your major assets are in the radio space. You own Jacaranda FM, which people in Joburg will know very well, of course, and East Coast Radio, which is used to be Radio Port Natal down in Durban, didn't it? It morphed into East Coast Radio eventually, I think.
Yeah. And East Coast now is the biggest station in KZN. So,
right.
It's kind of a market leader there, whereas it's slightly more competitive in the Joburg, Pretoria area.
Jacaranda is also a huge station.
Yeah.
And it's got huge reach as well. I mean, I drive out into the countryside and all the way up into Limpopo and Mpumalanga, I can pick up Jacaranda in the smallest little dorps out in the middle of nowhere.
I think we get a lot of loyalty for that reason, right? Mm. And often with our app where users can stream, people appreciate the fact that they can be out of the broadcast area even and still be listening to the station.
Yes.
So there's a lot of loyalty there. It's a great community.
Okay. So you've got some other assets. You've got a video productions business. You do enterprise content type stuff. You've got an ad sales business. All of this, to me, as a non-expert on these things, seems like a million miles away from video gaming. So how did the video gaming side of this actually come about?
It is and it isn't, right? Because as a media business, we've got a digital portfolio, right? Mm-hmm. And within that portfolio, there obviously are various different content plays. Esports forms one of those, right? So it's a emerging behavior and community that it's equivalent of, you know, being around it when football was invented or rugby or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. It's right at the beginning. No one knows how big it's going to get. Globally, the numbers are insane. I mean, League of Legends has 60 million players a month, right? So these are really big numbers. And the audiences are growing in terms of people who watch these competitive gamers play. And it's moving out of the computer room off of Twitch into stadium environments. So you're now starting to see like big physical audiences collecting and watching gaming in Europe, Asia, North America. And we're starting to see the beginning of it here in South Africa.
So like I would go and watch the rugby, for example, at Emirates Park here in Johannesburg. People are actually buying tickets and they're going to sit in the stadium to watch competitive gaming.
Exactly.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. And the there's a bunch of sort of auxiliary cultures to that, like the cosplay culture, which you would have seen at Rage.
Yes.
I mean, Rage is really like the nexus of the whole gaming culture, industry, and everything that's attached to it. Whereas esports is kind of like a subsection of that, which is more focused on, I guess, the team aspect of it and the audience aspect of it. So you don't have to be a gamer to watch esports.
Yeah.
Although it really does help to understand what you're busy seeing.
Yeah. Well, it helps in, I suppose, watching rugby as well, if you don't know what the rules are.
I think, you could understand rugby in about 5 minutes of explanation, right?
Sure.
But to try and explain 120 euros, six different items, five different spells, three lanes, it's complicated, right? Yeah. And you can't just sit and watch it and go, oh, okay, I know what just happened there.
Yeah, and there are many games, not just one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's sort of emerging along with that is the industry of casters, right? So these are the voices who are doing the commentary on top of the gaming.
Right.
So there's that that's also happening now. And what you see, as Fiber rolls out, people can more easily create their own YouTube channels, their own Twitch channels, and start casting and doing that stuff themselves.
I think Microsoft's also started doing this as well, streaming video games off the Xbox network.
Everyone's doing it, right? So Facebook and Blizzard did a deal, so you can now stream from Overwatch and Heroes of the Storm directly onto Facebook,
okay,
which is great. Amazon bought Twitch for $1 billion. And Twitch started as Justin TV. I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
Yeah. So and that became a $1 billion business. Can you believe it?
Incredible.
So there's a lot of things. And YouTube obviously have their YouTube gaming environment, which works really well in South Africa because they're local pops for those video streams.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So why esports? Why did you decide to get into the space? Is it what's the business model first of all? I suppose.
So, those two things are interlinked, right? Mm. So, as a media business, we like to experiment with new things. So, firstly, there's a lot of experimentation attached to this from a business model point of view. But we see media rights, sponsorships, and eventing as being the three sort of main business models that are attached to esports. And there are obviously a lot of others like merchandising, for example, e-commerce, ticketing, that kind of stuff. But as esports graduates onto television, there's going to be like the value is going to emerge around like actually owning the tournaments and the events and stuff like that. So that's sort of our that's how we justify it internally. The thing that's actually driving it is just a bunch of passionate individuals who either have a gaming background or who feel very strongly that this is something that it's a community that we want to participate in and try and help build from the sort of bottom up.
Mm. Are you a gamer yourself?
I am.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's a passion there as well.
Yeah, I'm trying to avoid it getting classified as a passion project, right? Because I would do it even if I wasn't a gamer.
Right.
But it does help, like all the people running the business are either ex-semi-professional gamers or have played quite a bit in their lives and, can sort of understand these things when they see them and, have a bit of an instinct for it.
Sure. So tell me a bit about what the actual market looks like. How many tournaments happen on a worldwide basis that are maybe of scale? Do you have global tournaments like we have the Olympics and the Rugby World Cup and that sort of thing where people travel to different countries or given the nature of the internet, do people play remotely? Give me an idea of how it actually works.
So globally there's two streams, right? So there are the professional and semi-professional tournaments and leagues that are run, and those have insane prize pools. Like the Dota 2 International had $19 million prize pool last year. This year it'll probably go to 25.
That's insane.
about 95% of that is contributed by players, right? So these are players contributing into the prize pool.
Wow.
It's really amazing. And what you do is you buy this thing called a compendium,
yeah.
which is basically a ticket to watch the games virtually.
Yeah.
And quarter of the revenue from the compendium goes into the prize pool every year. So the big esports on a professional level are Dota 2, Counter-Strike or CSGO, which is a military tactical shooter, like a first-person game. And then League of Legends, which is probably the biggest from an audience point of view.
Why those games specifically?
So Dota 2 and League of Legends are what are called MOBAs, right? So a MOBA is like a top-down game where two teams of five compete against each other for territory and objectives. And those have emerged as an esport, I think, because the community just adopted them at a certain time. And there's sort of like a right time, right place type thing that happened with them. And Blizzard have recently released, or more lately released, something called Heroes of the Storm, which is a competitor to those two.
Okay.
One of the older esports is StarCraft, right? And
yeah.
StarCraft in Asia has always been big. The, you know, when the, like this, the football teams in Asian countries would go to participate in the World Cup, the StarCraft team would come and send them off to inspire them, you know, that they can be quite cool on the field, that sort of thing. And then there's the other stream, which is the fact that esports is becoming part of the Asian Olympics, and it probably will be an Olympic sport quite soon, right? And so there are, in parallel to all these professional organizations, there's going to be a sort of grassroots upwards type government support structure that exists to get national or like pro tier esports athletes onto the world stage. And there is an organization already that does that called Mindsport South Africa. And they run all the school leagues, the varsity leagues, and they've been instrumental in getting South Africans into international, but competing on a country versus country level as opposed to a team versus team level.
Mm. Mm. Okay. In South Africa, is esports recognized in any way by the government as a sport?
It is. So you can get colors, mm-hmm. And you can be a pro tier esports player. So we've sent CSGO players internationally. So it's all there and it's happening.
Yeah.
But what's happening now, as you can see, there's like a groundswell, right? So it's been in the background for the last 4 or 5 years. In fact, Mindsport South Africa has been around since the 80s, actually, and they do other things as well, like chess, that sort of stuff. So it's gaining momentum now, right? Mm. And suddenly the media is looking at it, saying, well, what's the local version of these international tournaments and so on? And that's sort of been the time when we come in as a media business and start growing that.
Mm. Do we have any superstar players in South Africa that compete with the top guys in the world?
There's a team called Bravado yeah. Gaming, and they routinely win every CSGO tournament. So CSGO, unfortunately, if you're not in Bravado at the moment in South Africa, I think it's a little bit depressing, right? Because they're a very well-run organization, and they're quite far ahead in certain aspects. In Dota 2, it's a little bit more evenly balanced, right? So Bravado are a contender in Dota 2, but they're not guaranteed to win their games necessarily. And there's quite a nice set of what are called MGOs or multi-game organizations that exist in the country now. And it's been partly due to the fact that Telkom have been running a gaming league for a long time. They've been quite instrumental in sort of professionalizing the space.
They've invested a lot of money in this. In fact, they've created their own company now to
yeah.
focus on this, VS Gaming, I think
yeah.
it's called.
So, and you know what's great about that is I think for them, for the longest time, the DGL was basically a marketing channel for Telkom type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this move towards slightly distancing the brand gives them a lot more freedom to do other things. So I think it's going to be very good for the industry as a whole.
Mm. Mm. And MTN is also a sponsor. They sponsored your tournament that you had last year. They're continuing as a sponsor. What is it called? The Mega 8 Esports Tournament. That happened last December, is that right?
Yeah, so we run four events, four virtual tournaments a year.
Okay.
So we do a We've just done the Autumn Cup, which is a CSGO Cup. We're doing the Winter Cup next weekend. And so every season we'll do a cup, and it alternates between CSGO and Dota.
Okay.
And then
where do you do this? Is it a physical place where you congregate, where everyone congregates to play?
So currently it's all virtual, right?
Okay.
So you can imagine the logistics, but you basically got to get 10 players into a lobby. They're all over the country in different places. Some of the teams, for example, Bravado, in the last cup, they took over like a part of Caesar's Palace, I think.
Okay.
And they just owned it and like played together from there. So the teams organize where they are physically. But with virtual tournaments, you have interesting factors like, you know, there's ping time, lag, all that sort of stuff that affects player performance. So our goal from the Spring Cup onwards is to switch to physical LAN tournaments, and then gradually bring in a studio audience into that environment. Our main focus is just getting the thing televised properly.
Yeah.
So we're sort of taking our steps of learning first were, can we run a tournament? That was us in December. Like, can we even get it working?
Yeah.
And then the second tournament, we started looking at how well can we produce media around it and content, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and then get to the physical audience phase probably towards the end of this year.
Okay. Okay. So have you identified where you'll do this yet, or was it too early to tell?
In terms of physical venue. Mm. So we've been having a lot of conversations about, so our video production business has just bought a big chunk of Brightwater Commons.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a theater there. So we're thinking about turning that into an esports arena.
Oh, right.
Like a dedicated space, because then we can seat 300 people, fly cameras all over the place, you know, and do other kind of fun things in that area. But we're also starting to do a lot of stuff with FIFA, and, you know, what we're actually quite excited about is filling up community halls in townships with people who are there to watch guys play football, you know, on PlayStation or Xbox, and compete quite locally. And right now it's just a question of, like, how much time we have and how much focus we have to do all of these different things. But there's just the massive opportunities all over.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. I was going to ask, actually, you mentioned consoles. Is this predominantly a PC or predominantly a console-based thing, esports?
So CSGO and Dota 2 are PC-based, and they actually don't exist on consoles.
Mm-hmm.
FIFA is console-based primarily, although there is a PC version of it. But I think when you look at competitive gaming there, it's going to be either on Xbox or PlayStation.
Mm. Okay. Any idea how big the esports industry is in South Africa? Has there been any research done?
So we've done our own sort of ad hoc research. Our estimation is that from a prize pool point of view, we think that there's about 5 million rand in prize pool that we know of today for this calendar year. It's probably going to go up to about 7 or 8. There's some organizations that are coming in, like ESL, for example, is one of the biggest global brands in esports. They're coming in at Rage, so there's going to be a bunch of money flying around there. In terms of the value of the sponsorship market, it's probably in the 30 to 40 million rand range at the moment. But that goes down to the level of the team sponsorships, that sort of thing, and the money invested by companies that are running tournaments, leagues, and so on. And we've seen a lot of brands sort of dip their toes in the water recently. Samsung just sponsored an event called Metal State, which is a CSGO tournament with a million rand prize pool. So the brands are coming. The tipping point, I think, is going to be when the teams have enough money flowing in on a monthly basis to be able to actually be professional as opposed to doing it part-time.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that difference between Bravado and the other teams already. And it's going to follow. It's really a factor of how much money there is available in the year for the taking, and how well distributed it is. So one of the key things that we're doing to try and grow the industry is to try and spread the money out so that it's not a situation where one team takes all the money.
Mm.
So in our leagues, we're going to be distributing the money quite evenly across the different divisions for example, so that the guys at the bottom of the divisions can still get some cash out to fund their gaming, that sort of thing.
Okay, and who, in terms of the audiences that watch this, either through streaming or through attending a venue somewhere to watch this live, what is the profile of that audience? Is it predominantly young and male?
So if you look at YouTube, so if I take our recent tournament statistics as an example, so it's like 96% male.
Mm-hmm.
What you tend to find, like referencing Rage again, is that the physical events tend to attract a lot more female audience, but the online viewing still is quite a male thing.
What's the reason for that?
I don't know. I think it's just if you it's not a big female gaming scene that I've seen on in terms of the competitive side of it.
Mm.
And that's something that really needs to be developed over the next few years. I think if it's going to have legitimacy, it's got to, this whole esports scene needs to go through a bit of a transformation in itself. If you look at the age groups on our stream, the biggest age group was 25 to 35,
mm-hmm.
And then 18 to 24. You know, and then 13 to 18.
Okay, so it's a younger male skew.
Yeah, although, you know, 35-year-old males, I used to think 35 was old when I was 22. So it depends on your perspective. You know, I think that, like what I've been saying to brands who want to get involved in the space is that you're dealing with people that are very financially active, they're at the top of the pyramid, and they're probably making decisions about what technology products get bought in the household, you know, and that's quite a powerful constituent to be talking to.
Mm.
And millennials are hard to get to, right? I mean, if you think about it, they don't watch TV, they don't really listen to the radio, so finding them and just kind of getting them in one place is quite challenging.
Yeah, supposedly they're all on Twitch. Snapchat.
Yeah, well, I think Snapchat's possibly even younger, you know, but you'd find them on Twitch and YouTube a lot.
Yeah. Is there an opportunity, I mean, just looking at the streaming space, is there an opportunity to build a streaming platform here in South Africa for this, or would it make more sense just to use the Twitch, YouTube platforms to do that here?
You know what, that's an interesting question, right? I think, like, the existing platforms bring audience. So Twitch and YouTube already have a ton of people watching games, and their discovery is really good, you know. There's always a challenge around monetization. Like, so how do you make money from your stream if it's on YouTube? You're probably not generating a lot of revenue. But is that really the play, right? I mean, for us, our sponsors get logos embedded in the screen all the time.
Mm.
So it goes deeper than just sort of having ad placement in between the breaks and that sort of stuff. I think someone could do it. I don't think that I would have the energy to try and compete with YouTube and Twitch.
Or Amazon.
Yeah, or Amazon, yeah. Exactly.
Great. Just lastly, Vincent, if the guys listening to this podcast want to watch your next tournament, will it be the Winter Tournament?
Yeah, so it's the Winter Cup.
How do they do it? Where do they watch?
So if they go onto YouTube and search for Mega 8 Esports, they'll find it there.
Okay.
And it's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. That the games are on.
Okay. Have you got a date for the winter one yet?
Yes, I do. I'm just checking my diary, actually, because I can never actually remember what dates are which. But it is the 25th, 26th, and 27th.
Of June?
Of May.
Of May. Okay. Yeah. So it's coming up quite soon. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So go check out Mega 8. That's 8 as a number. Esports, one word.
Yeah.
On YouTube, and you can see that. Vincent, thanks. This has been a fascinating discussion.
Thanks,
and I wish you all the best in growing this business. It sounds like a really exciting growth area.
Thank you very much.